Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The simple and delicate women truly thought that Lord Sri Krishna, their beloved husband, followed them and was dominated by them. They were unaware of the extent of the glories of their husband, as the atheists are unaware of him as the supreme controller. Purport. Even the transcendental wives of Lord Sri Krishna did not know completely the unfathomable glories of the Lord. This ignorance is not mundane, because there is some action of the internal potency of the Lord in the exchange of feelings between him and his eternal associates. The Lord exchanges transcendental relations in five ways, as proprietor, master, friend, son, and lover. And in each of these pastimes, he plays fully by the potency of Yoga Maya, the internal potency. He plays exactly like an equal friend with the cowherd boys, or even with friends like Arjuna. He plays exactly like a son in the presence of Yashoda Mata. He plays exactly like a lover in the presence of the cowherd damsels. And he plays exactly like a husband in the presence of the queens of Dwaraka. Such devotees of the Lord never think of the Lord as a supreme, but think of him exactly as a common friend, a pet son, or a lover, or husband very much dear to heart and soul. That is the relation between the Lord and his transcendental devotees, who act as his associates in the spiritual sky, where there are innumerable Vaikuntha planets. When the Lord descends, he does so along with his entourage to display a complete picture of the transcendental world, where pure love and devotion for the Lord prevail without any mundane tinge of lording it over the creation of the Lord. Such devotees of the Lord are all liberated souls, perfect representatives of the marginal or internal potency in complete negation of the influence of the external potency. The wives of Lord Krishna were made to forget the immeasurable glories of the Lord by the internal potency, so that there might not be any flaw of exchange. And they took it for granted that the Lord was a henpecked husband, always following them in lonely places. In other words, even the personal associates of the Lord do not know him perfectly well. So what do the thesis writers or mental speculators know about the transcendental glories of the Lord? The mental speculators present different theses as to his becoming the cause of the creation, the ingredients of the creation, or the material and efficient causes of the creation, etc. But all this is but partial knowledge about the Lord. Actually, they are as ignorant as a common man. The Lord can be known by the mercy of the Lord only, and by no other means. But since the dealings of the Lord with his wives are based on pure transcendental love and devotion, the wives are all on the transcendental plane without material contamination. Samenire bhala mudha shrinyam chanu vrataraha. A pramana vido bratur ishvaram matayo yata. The simple and delicate women truly thought that Lord Sri Krishna, their beloved husband, followed them and was dominated by them. They were unaware of the extent of the glories of their husband, as the atheists are unaware of him as the supreme controller. So we have some very interesting words here. We have abala and mudaha. Mudaha is a plural of muda. So muda generally means what? An ass, a fool, a donkey. So here in the West, we don't see very many donkeys and mules. Right? Maybe if you want to go down in the Grand Canyon, then you have to go down in a mule. But they're not very common on our streets. In fact, there's no life very common on our streets, just cars, right? You drive down a street in the West, unless it's right in the middle of New York or something, you don't see any life except for plants. But in more simple cultures, like in India, you regularly are going to see these mudas, these asses, walking on the side of the road. And in India, they try to be very efficient. I don't know how effective they are, but they try to be very efficient. And so they pile as much stuff on whatever can move, whether it's a camel or a ox or a tractor or a truck or a whatever, a donkey, as they can. So these donkeys, they're loaded up to their peak capacity, carrying heavy bricks on either side of them. There'll be a big bag full of bricks or grass or whatever. I'm sure that someone there has calculated the maximum carrying weight of a donkey, and it's within one straw less than that. And these donkeys, these mudas, they're carrying this heavy burden. Why? So that their owner can give them some grass. And they think, I have to carry this burden for this grass. They don't understand that if they ran away from home, of course, very hard to run away because their owners will hobble them. But if they ran away from home, the grass would be available without working. So this is the mudha. And then we have the word here, abala. Abala is a euphemism for a woman, just like even in Western society, not so much anymore, but used to be, that women were called the weaker sex, the fairer sex, or the weaker sex. So today, women don't like to be known as weaker, but biologically, women, of course, are weaker. Interesting, though, women have often more staying power. But this lack of muscle strength by the women has become quite a problem because in America, at least, there's a law called Title IX, which is supposed to give full athletic facility to girls. The girls have to have equal athletic facility as boys in all educational institutions. And the problem with this is that when the girls, their bodies are constructed differently, the girls end up getting certain injuries, especially to their hips and knees, because their body is designed not for those same sort of athletic abilities. And also, what happens if the women build up too much muscle to fat ratio, then they lose their fertility, generally temporarily, but anyway, they lose their fertility. Women need a higher fat to muscle ratio than men. So biologically, women can be called abala, weak, not strong. In fact, I know one devotee whose initiated name is Abala. But generally, we hear these two qualities here, Abala and Mudha, not strong and foolish. Generally, these are disqualifications for spiritual life. But here they're being used to describe not only the most qualified, but the most accomplished. So qualification indicates your potential. And accomplishment shows what has actually been done, not just potential to do, but having been done. So here are people who are, they have accomplished, they have attained the sadhya, they have attained the perfection. They are seeing the Lord face to face, their existence in their spiritual body. They have achieved their eternal relationship with the Lord. On every level of accomplishment, they have accomplished it without any question. And yet they are referred here as abala and mudha, weak and foolish like an ass. So how is this possible? And in fact, they're even compared to foolish persons. They're compared, Prabhupada says here, to the atheists, to the mental speculators, who Prabhupada says in the purport are really no better than the common man. And Krishna, of course, explains this mudha at least twice in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, Avajananti mam mudha manusim tanum ashritam param bhavam ajananto mama bhuta maheshwaram. Fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental glories and my supreme dominion over all that be. Avajananti. Ajanan. They don't know. They don't have any jnana. They don't have any knowledge. And when Krishna talks about who doesn't surrender to him, it says, Namam dustritino mudha prapadyante naradama mayaya paritajnanam asuram bhavam ashritaha. So those who bhavam, who asuram bhavam ashritaha, who take shelter of the view of the atheists who are Avijananti, who are, sorry, Maya Parityagnana, whose knowledge is stolen by illusion, Nara Dhamma, the lowest among humans, and the Mudhas, the fools. They don't surrender unto me. But here again, we find the fully surrendered devotees are described here as Mudha. In terms of Bala, it's explained that one needs to have Bala. One needs to have the strength of Balaram, the original guru, in order to access Krishna consciousness. One has to have two things, two components to this Bala, is faith, Shraddha, and exhibiting that faith in action or sadhana. And without faith and action, Shraddha and sadhana, one cannot have Bala. And without Bala, it is not possible, Prabhupada says, to approach Krishna. One must have the power. But here, these women are described abala. They are without power. Now, it's interesting, of course, that Srila Prabhupada translates these words as simple and delicate. So for Muda, he is translating it as simple rather than foolish. And as abala, he's translating it as delicate rather than weak or powerless. So here we see a great mystery. This is explained also in the Bhagavatam that there are two people who are free from material suffering, the fools and the transcendentalists, whereas everyone in the middle is suffering. And the great mystery is that those on the highest platform of transcendence appear to have something in common with those at the lowest level of material life. So the people at the lowest level of material life are perhaps crazy people. People who are, we can't say crazy anymore, I suppose, but we were just watching a number of films about Srila Prabhupada, the following Srila Prabhupada series that Yadubar and Vishaka put together. We were watching this yesterday for Prabhupada's Vyas Puja Day. And Jyotirmayi told such a funny story how when Prabhupada came to France, he was meeting with a lot of dignitaries. And there was one psychiatrist who had, I think he had written or spoken some about Eastern spirituality. So they thought that he might be interested to meet Srila Prabhupada. So they invited him to the meeting. And when the psychiatrist came, he kept asking, "Where is my patient? Where is my patient?" And they said, "We didn't bring you here to meet a patient. We brought you here because we thought you might want to learn more about this philosophy and meet our spiritual master." And then he was so offended that there was no patient, that he'd been called unnecessarily, so he left. When Prabhupada was told about this, he was laughing, and he said he did not understand that he was the patient. So materially speaking, the lowest human beings are those who are unable to have full mental facility due to some developmental delays or due to some mental illness. But we find that the residents of Vrindavan, they also display a kind of madness. Just like Prabhupada wrote this wonderful letter to Atreya Rishi saying, don't look for some sort of utopia where there's no fault. He says in the spiritual world, the gopis, they're running to see Krishna dressed as if they were little children trying to dress themselves. Like here at my son's, we have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. And generally, they ask someone older to help them get dressed. But sometimes they try to dress themselves. So they may put both of their legs into one of the leg openings, or they may put their legs into the arm openings, or they try to put the arm openings on their head. Or they put some leg opening over their head, and so they are wearing pants or shorts on their upper body. So this is how little children dress themselves. And Prabhupada said the gopis, when they ran to see Krishna, they looked as if little children trying to dress themselves. Their clothes were on upside down and backwards. what was supposed to be a necklace was put on their waist and so forth. There, half one earring, one eye made up. And he said when Krishna Radharani, one time he went to milk a bull instead of a cow. So this sort of madness is there in the highest realm. This sort of a foolishness. And this foolishness includes, it includes that one doesn't even have an awareness of the full glories of the Lord. Of course, who can know the full glories of the Lord? Even Krishna doesn't know his full glory. How is that? Well, just like all of us like a good mystery. We all like a good mystery. So I've been reading some books about how to make a dynamic presentation. I'm always trying to improve my service. And one of the points that we're making is if you want people to be involved and attentive, you don't just tell them everything up front. You let things unfold and have them be some air of mystery. And the authors were describing how we will read or listen to something where a mystery is unfolding, even if it's about a topic that we don't have any interest. And the authors gave the example of finding out what the rings of Saturn are made out of and of reading a scientific article that posed it as a mystery, which was gradually unfolding. So we all delight in discovery, in finding knowledge, in understanding. Right? If we don't want everything up front. So Krishna is also like that. He delights in discovery. He delights in gaining understanding. If you just think about the thrill when you understand something, and you're trying to understand it, you're trying to figure it out, and that eureka moment, was that Archimedes, who he was in the bathtub, and he had this eureka moment. I think the story was that the king had given some gold to a crown maker, and when the crown came back, the king wanted to know if it was all made of gold that he had given, or if the crown maker had mixed some other metals, if he had adulterated the metal, and he didn't know how to do it. Now, how was he going to do it? And so Archimedes was able to understand that you can weigh things by displacement in water. He understood that while he was taking a bath. And he was so excited, he jumped out of the bath and started running down the street saying, "Eureka, Eureka, I have found it, I have found it." So this thrill of discovery, right, what we call in the Hare Krishna movement realization, we love it. We love to be hearing something or reading something or talking about something. And, oh, right, so Krishna also likes that. Therefore, Krishna is always discovering new things about himself and new things about his devotees. He's always expanding himself. This is nicely explained in Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila, Chapter 4, how Radharani's love is already all pervasive with no room for expansion, and yet it is expanding. So in the same way, Krishna is already everywhere with no room for expansion, and yet he is expanding. And as he expands, then his knowledge of himself has to keep up. So his knowledge of himself, Prabhupada explains, is always a little behind his expansion. And Krishna is also always trying to understand his devotees. Right? Sarvasya cha hamriti sannivitso matasmati yoganam apohanam cha. Krishna is in all of our hearts, giving us knowledge. And we can say Krishna knows us perfectly. But that's boring. You know, if you have a relationship with somebody where you know them perfectly, where you knew every single thing, there was no mystery. So that would be really boring. I forget who it was, some famous writer. This is in some classic literature. Sorry, I cannot remember the name of the author nor the name of the story. But it was about a man who falls in love with a mysterious woman. She won't tell him anything about her past. And she does a very peculiar thing every day. She goes to an empty room that she rents, dresses up in a costume, and sits by the window. And when the man tries to unravel the mystery of this woman, he's not able to do so. And the woman ends up dying without revealing the mystery. So the man goes to a friend, and he said, "I can't understand why I was so attracted to this woman and what the mystery of her was." And the friend says, "Probably the only reason you were attracted to her was that she was mysterious. You wanted to know more." So So although Krishna apparently knows everything about his devotees, he doesn't. In fact, he doesn't know everything even about his topmost devotee, Srimati Radharani. And it is to know about Srimati Radharani that he accepts the mood of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that he accepts the mood of Gaura Hari. Hari as a golden form. Because as Krishna, he's trying and trying and trying. What does Radharani experience? What does her love feel like? I know what my love for her feels like, but what does her love for me feel like? And how do I taste to her? What is the flavor of me that she experiences? I know what she tastes like to me. What do I taste like to her? And what kind of happiness does she feel upon having a relationship with me? I can't understand this. I've tried and tried and I can't. It remains a mystery for him. And therefore, Krishna accepts Radharani's mood and Radharani's color in order to be able to experience that. But because Radharani is always expanding, it's not that, okay, now I know it. Now done. Now let's go on to another mystery. But that mystery is always expanding. Always expanding. We talked about this before. Always satisfied, but never satiated. So the devotees also, they do not fully understand Krishna. Their knowledge of Krishna is always expanding, and many aspects of Krishna are hidden from them. And this makes everything sweeter and more exciting. Now, sweeter because when a person's a very big man, one of my friends sent me a little video the other day of somebody asking Bill Gates, all right, what's the next industry on the horizon that can produce more Bill Gates? Because I want to get in on that industry. And I was thinking, you know, anyone who talks, it's like they're saying, I want a piece of you. And anybody that Bill Gates talks to, he's got to figure that that person wants something from him. And he's probably right. I mean, if Bill Gates walked into your room right now, would you just want to know him as a person? Or would you have some of his money and some of his influence? The chances are the latter. It would be very difficult. I mean, if Bill Gates knocked on my door right now and sat down and wanted to talk to me about Krishna consciousness, it would be really, really difficult for me just to care about him, the person, and to put aside any kind of desire. I'd be thinking, wow, I have, you know, this project I want to do for Prabhupada and this project I want to do, and maybe he'd give me some money. And of course you can say, well, that's also to benefit him. But to really have that mood would be very difficult. There would definitely pull into the relationship some desire on my part to share in his opulence, to get some sort of benefit of his opulence. And in fact, to some extent, that's the mood of the residents of Vaikuntha. They're attracted to the Lord's opulences, and they want to share in the Lord's opulences. With love, they're not trying to, as Prabhupada says here, they're not trying to exploit. Prabhupada's talking here about the Vaikuntha planet. He said they don't have any mundane tinge of lording it over the creation of the Lord. So there's no envy. The residents of Vaikuntha, they're not envious of Krishna. They're not trying to take away some of Krishna's overlordship. But they do have some desire to share in the opulence of the Lord. There's some, I mean, it's all on the liberated platform. From our perspective, there's nothing at all. But still, there are gradations. There's perfect, more perfect, and most perfect. And so they have some desire to share in the opulences of the Lord. It's there. Aware of the opulences of the Lord, if they weren't aware of his opulences, they wouldn't be so interested in having a relationship with him. Their interest in the relationship with him is mixed with a desire for their own situation, and that's fine. There's no problem with that. The good citizens of a country can also have a desire to share the opulence of that country. It doesn't make them any less of good citizens. It doesn't, you know, you don't have to go to prison just because you want some share in the glories and opulences of your country. You only go to prison if you are trying to use the opulences and the glories of your country to do harm to your country. So as long as you're using those glories and opulences in the service of your country, That's no problem. But higher than that is somebody who wants to serve their country without wanting anything for themselves. You know, the people who go into the military and are willing to sacrifice their own bodily health and bodily abilities. They don't care whether or not they get the opulences and the benefits of their country. They're doing it so other people can enjoy those opulences. So they're fighting in a war so that and willing to risk their lives and their health and their mobility so that other people can enjoy. They're not concerned about their own enjoyment. So that's a much higher level. For the people who sacrifice like that are given great honor and facility by the other persons in the country. So the higher devotees, the more intimate devotees of the Lord, they are not interested in sharing the opulences of the Lord. And therefore, knowing about the opulence of the Lord is a distraction. You know, if your son is the president, you know, your husband is the president, you want to be in a position where you can forget that he's the president. You know, otherwise it's a little awkward. I mean, if you want to share in his glory, you know, if you're Michelle Obama and you want to shine in the elected spotlight of Barack, then, you know, you want to be at a state dinner with him. But when you're at a state dinner with him, you can't be very intimate. You can't be going, oh, my little honey fuzzy or whatever they call each other. So if you want to do that, you have to be in some other place where the president is not so obviously the president, where you can forget that he's the president, where he just becomes your husband. So this is the situation of those in Dwarka, Mathura, and Vrindavan to various degrees. Even these wives of Dwarka are to some extent aware of the Lord's opulence, and they have some desire to share in the Lord's opulence. Not as much as the residents of the greater Vaikuntha, but more so than the residents of Vrindavan, to whom the Lord's opulence and majesty is basically non-existent in their awareness. So therefore, we find that the residents of Vrindavan, they're not worshiping Krishna. Of course, they call on Krishna when there's a problem. You know, when Indra... But their worship is of Narayan. They're not worshiping Krishna. And Mother Yasoda, the Rupa Goswami is explaining that Mother Yasoda says to Krishna before he goes into the forest every day, now, my dear Krishna, before you go in the forest, always take shelter of Lord Narayana. And if there's any danger in the forest, then please pray to Narayana. She doesn't have an awareness that her son is Narayana. And this is such a sweet exchange between Yasoda and Krishna. Even when Yasoda gets some awareness that her son is Narayana, when she sees the universal form in his mouth, she still doesn't lose her feeling that Krishna is my son. Whereas, say, Arjuna, when he saw the universal form, he wasn't really able to maintain that mood of friendship, and it was very disturbing to him. Right? Or Kunti, Kunti's prayers. So Kunti starts from the Lord's abdomen. She doesn't start from his feet because she's thinking, well, because I'm his aunt, if I start talking about his feet, it may be a little embarrassing for him. Because I'm socially his superior. At the same time, she's glorifying him as a supreme controller. And she's bewildered by Yasoda's intimate relationship where Krishna is actually, not pretending, but actually afraid of Yasoda. Of course, even the gopis will sometimes talk about Krishna's other incarnations, but usually in a critical way. And when they're looking for Krishna, they do say, you're not actually the son of Yasoda, but you are the indwelling witness. But still, we find that those statements by the gopis, they don't disturb the gopis' basic feeling that Krishna is my lover. Just like if you're alone, if Michelle and Barack Obama are alone together, so she knows in some place, she knows that her husband is the president. It's not that she doesn't know, but it's out of her conscious awareness. It doesn't disturb when they are privately together, her personal relationship with him. That remains the same, whether it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. So it's not that the person running for president, when they lose the election, that then their wife leaves them and says, well, I'm only going to associate with you when you're president. So She's his wife before he's president, while he's president, after. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Not only does it not matter, but it's somewhat of a disturbance. So therefore, you can say that these queens of Dwarka, that they have something in common with the weak and the foolish persons who don't know Krishna, because they're also thinking, he's my husband. I mean, they're thinking, not only are they thinking he's my husband, they're thinking that he's subordinate to them. They think they own him. This is the mood of mamata. Krishna is mine. Which, of course, there's degrees of this, as explained in Ujjvala Nilamani by Rupa Goswami, how Chandravali is more thinking she belongs to Krishna, and Radharani is more thinking that Krishna belongs to her. But Prabhupada very clearly explains that all the devotees, all of the intimate devotees of the Lord, have to have this mood of mamata, that Krishna is mine, that Krishna belongs to me. And so here are the queens, they're thinking Krishna belongs to me. There's a little interesting side note here about male-female psychology, because the Shastra is over and over again emphasizing how the woman should be subordinate to her husband, the woman should follow and obey her husband. You know, it's interesting that there aren't a separate series of verses in the Bhagavatam about how a man should treat his wife, but there are a number of verses in the seventh canto about how the woman should treat her husband, that she should defer to his wishes and be very respectful to his relatives and friends. So why is that there? Because the natural tendency among the human being is for the man to be subordinate to the wife. In fact, there's one purport where Prabhupada says that if the man is not subordinate to the wife, there'll be a disturbance in household life. So this is the natural tendency. And King Muchukunda refers to this when he's talking to Krishna in the cave. And he said, I went out and I conquered kings in all directions, but when I entered the inner chamber of my palace, I became subservient to my queens for sense gratification. So this is the general tendency. You know, the man thinks I'm the king of the castle, but if he doesn't keep his wife happy, then everything's going to fall apart. Right? This is a natural psychology. However, that's not such a good situation for spiritual life, because the male form has more facility for self-realization, generally, more freedom in the male form. There's less covering in the mode. So although it does happen sometimes, as Prabhupada says, that the wife becomes the guru of her husband, generally, if the woman is following her husband, if he's a devotee, then that's much better. And if the man is not under the control of the woman for sense gratification, especially sex and eating. But here we see among Krishna and his queens that the women are in charge, that he becomes their follower, anuvrata. Vrata means like a vow, anuvrata, following their vow, raha, in a lonely place. So it appears that Krishna is simply following them, thinking that he's dependent on them for sense gratification. And the queens have that mood. They think, oh, my husband is just wrapped around my little finger. And they have good reason to think that way. You know, Satyabhama says, hey, you gave my co-wife a parijata flower. I want one too. Takes her to the heavenly planets and gets her a parijata tree. And that Krishna is fulfilling all their desires. With Radharani, Krishna's falling at the feet of Radharani. I'm so sorry. Please let me back. Please take me back. So to this extent, they don't know the glories of Krishna. They think that Krishna is subordinate to them, that he's dependent on them. Like Nanda Yasoda, they think if I don't feed Krishna, then he'll die. And Krishna even takes this mood in his deity form. So those of us who are worshiping the Lord as a deity, so, you know, we're the ones providing. It appears that, you know, we've got to buy him an altar and cushions and clothes, and we have to dress him and give him a bath. And I remember one of my grandkids asked me about this, you know, that we have to bathe Krishna. He said, isn't that a little strange? I mean, I wouldn't want someone bathing me. And we said, no, actually, the royalty they used to have, I don't know if they still do, I doubt it. They probably take their own shower now, but at least in former times, So royalty, somebody would come and bathe them. Somebody would come and dress them. Somebody would take care of them. So Krishna takes this form as a deity so that it appears that he is dependent on us. So this mood of the queens of Dwarka, this is our goal in the Hare Krishna movement. You know, the first time I met Srila Prabhupada, when my father asked him if he could practice his own religion and still come to the temple, Prabhupada said, yes, as long as the goal of your religion is to know God and to love him. So for the beginning, for the beginning devotee, knowing God means knowing the greatness of the Lord. Therefore, we have in the second canto, third canto, Bhagavatam, we have descriptions of the Lord's glories in the material energy. Fifth canto, the glories of the Lord in the cosmology. So for the beginner, one has to do this. You can't skip it. You can't say, well, I'm going to just jump to the position of these queens in Dwarka. But we should always remember that that is our goal, that our knowing Krishna is not to know of his opulence so that we can either as a materialist, even a great materialist like a demigod, wanting to use that knowledge of his opulence to lord it over the material energy, nor do the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu even desire to go to Vaikuntha in a mood of sharing the Lord's opulences. That's not their mood. Therefore, Raghunath Das Goswami in his Manashiksha lists attraction to the Lord's feature of Narayana as an obstacle to Raj Prem. So we should always remember that our trying to know about Krishna has the goal of wanting to fall in love with him for him, wanting to serve him just because he is so wonderful, just because who he is, just is what we want. What the reason we want other people to have a relationship with us is just for us. I was reading this the other day in a manual about parenting, where the father's sitting in his chair, the author of the book, he's sitting in his chair, and his three-year-old son comes to him and says, "Why do you love me, Daddy?" And the daddy says, "Why do you think?" And he says, "Do you love me because I go to the potty now?" And the daddy says, "Well, I'm very happy that you use the potty, but that's not why I love you." And the three-year-old is thinking, he says, "Do you love me because I pick up my toys?" And daddy says, "Well, I'm happy you pick up your toys, but that's not why I love you." And the boy says, "Daddy, why do you love me?" And the author was saying, "Oh, I was wondering, I shouldn't have gotten in some discussion about unconditional love with a three-year-old. How foolish I am." And he thought, "Let me try to explain it." He said, "Well, I love you just because you're you." And the little boy got so excited, he started dancing around the room. He says, "You love me because I'm me, Daddy. You love me just because I'm me." And the author said for the next 2 days, every 10 minutes that the boy saw his father, he'd say, "You love me just because I'm me, Daddy. You love me just because I'm me." So that's how the residents of Vrindavan feel about Krishna. And they love Krishna so much. In fact, they find Krishna's naughty activities, difficult activities, to be endearing. Again, we see a little reflection of that in this world. We see a reflection of that in this world. When a boy and girl first fall in love, not after they've been married for 10 years, but when they first fall in love, they see each other's faults as endearing. Or parents with young children. You know, when your three-year-old knocks over the garbage can to be naughty, even if you're correcting them, you find their behavior endearing. You find their naughtiness endearing. So this is love. This is love. And if you don't have love, even the good qualities of others, you criticize. So this should be the goal of all of our Krishna conscious practice. The goal of our practice is not to gain facility to exploit the material world by gaining some of Krishna's powers. The goal of our practice is not to gain salvation, to get free of our suffering. The goal of our practice is not to share in the Lord's opulences and Vaikuntha. The goal of our practice is to enter into a transcendental kind of illusion. as explained here, the illusion of the eternal potency, which of course is Srimati Radharani. Mahatmanastu mam partha, daiming prakriti mashrita. To come under the shelter of Srimati Radharani. Well, someone wrote me an email the other day. How do I know that I'm making advancement? So I gave her maybe five or six things that she could look for. And one of them is, am I becoming more attached to Krishna? And that doesn't mean not to exactly to the philosophy or to Krishna as an abstract concept, but to Krishna as a person. When I hear about Krishna's activities with the queens, do I become attracted? Do I think, I'd like to see that. I'd like to be there. I'd like to participate in that. Are there any of Krishna's pastimes where one thinks, well, I'd really like to see that? You know, you read about Arjuna shooting Karna on the battlefield. Do you think, I'd like to see that? I'd like to see the river of blood that Krishna created in fighting with Jarasandhar. Or, you know, I'd like to see the Ras Lila. Or what to speak of, I'd like to enter into it. I wish I could dance with Krishna. I wish that I could play with Krishna. I wish that I could put on Krishna's ankle bells, whatever it may be. So do we have any of that? That feeling should be awakening. We should be looking. That should be the goal when we chant our Hare Krishna mantra on beads, our japa, when we're singing in the kirtan, when we're reading the scripture, when we're doing our services, whether we're cleaning the floor or working at a job, whatever service we've been given. Are we doing it with that mood of let me increase my attachment for Krishna so that I can also enter into these moods of these residents who are Abala and Muda, who with their simple delicacy are charming the Lord and entering into a kind of intimacy that cannot be imagined even by great philosophers, what you speak of ordinary, weak fools. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements.
Okay. I'd like to thank everyone very much for staying quiet during Mother Irma's presentation. I've unmuted everybody on pre-conferencing. So if anyone has any questions or comments, otherwise, please remain muted.
Hare Krishna. I just find it really hard to understand, and maybe it's because Krishna's can't be really comprehended, but how is it that Krishna can be all-knowing, he has all knowledge, and not really know himself? Excuse me.
Because it's fun. Because it's boring to know everything. And then Krishna is a lot more interested in fun.
Okay.
How can he? Because he prefers it that way. That's what he would prefer. Don't you like discovering things about yourself?
Yes.
Suppose that you had the ability in the next 10 minutes to learn everything that you could possibly learn about yourself, and there would never be anything further to learn about yourself at all.
Hmm.
Would you take it?
I think at first I would, but then after a while it would become boring.
Yes. I think so.
Yeah.
There's a pleasure in discovering oneself, isn't there?
Yeah, that's true.
There's a pleasure in discovering a hidden talent or I didn't know I could do that. Like when Kardama Muni made that aerial mansion and he was astonished. He didn't know he could do that.
Yeah, that's true.
And that was fun. I mean, one of the most fun things when I was working on the children's book, I had never written original stories before. I had never really done anything that was originally creative. My creativity had been limited up until that time with reworking other people's things. And I was able to write original stories. So it was such an incredible discovery that Krishna was giving me the ability. I mean, it was obvious that Krishna was giving me that ability. It wasn't an innate ability of mine. But it was a wonderful discovery. It was very enjoyable.
Yes, I understand that creative aspect, like discovering that, you know, wow, you know, you can do something that you didn't realize that you could.
Exactly. So, and Krishna's dynamic. He's always expanding. So he fully knows himself, but because he's always expanding, there's always more to know. And he is what he is because that's what's the most pleasurable. He is himself pleasure. And therefore, every aspect of his existence is going to be that which brings the greatest pleasure to him and to everyone else. That is, his very nature is that of pleasure. So the things which are the most pleasurable are going to be part of his nature.
Hi, thank you.
Mother Imala, I have a question. We were just reading in the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's instructions of Rupa Goswami. He was describing the different rasas. And the way it was being described is when one starts at Shanta Ras, then next comes Dasya Ras, and then it progresses to the next rasa. And then after that, then one goes on to this. It was a progression. I was asking in the discussion, we have our Stayi Bhava, you know, we're satisfied with whatever that relationship is with Krishna. But if there's this progression, for instance, if the highest is the Madhurya Rasa, then the conclusion of the discussion was that, okay, it goes progressively, you advance in your devotional service, and then when you get to a certain point, your Stayi Bhava, then you just stop. So one who gets, who gradually progresses up to, let's say, parental affection, he doesn't go beyond that. He or she doesn't go beyond that, because that at that point it's the Stayi Bhava. Is that a correct understanding?
Remember that we are individuals, and that any description of the path of devotion does not necessarily apply in the same way to everybody.
It was real mean. So I came to see you and you ran away. You even do it in Second Life.
I'll mute them. Sorry. Yeah. He doesn't understand their unmute.
Okay.
Okay. You're muted now.
Where did that come from? So what you just described is certainly true for some individuals, but not all. There are some individuals that when they awaken to their relationship with Krishna will immediately awaken to the position where they are, and that's where they are. So that may change for different people. I mean, Gopal Kumar attained Goloka Vrindavan by going through every single step, every single planet. That doesn't mean everybody will do that. Prabhupada explains this, I believe it's in the story of Dhruva Maharaj. I believe so. So it might be in Prithu Maharaj, where, you know, one can go step by step. You can go from this planet to a higher planet and then go to Goloka Vrindavan, or you can go directly. So, and I don't even think that we would say that one is better than the other. We're all individuals. I mean, I personally, I don't know if I should say this or not, but I personally know of a devotee in ISKCON who had that sort of step-by-step progression to discover what her rasa was. Because I remember first she came to me and she said, I don't know what to do. This stuff is happening to me and I feel that I have this relationship, but I didn't, you know, and talked about that for a while. And then a few years later, she came and she said, you know, something else is now happening. So that may happen, but that's people I know who are experiencing this, that is more uncommon than common for a person to go step by step through the rasas like that. Generally, when people awaken, they awaken to who they are.
Okay. Very good. This is very high stuff. But I started to ask because it's very curious.
We don't have a choice because that's what's happening in these verses and purport. So it's interesting that this is in the verses and purports in the first canto of Bhagavatam, but so it is. That's exactly the topics of today's verse and purport.
I do have another question, but I'll wait to see if someone else has. Anybody? Okay, if nobody's going to ask another question, then I will. In the purport, especially towards the end, he's talking about, Srila Prabhupada's talking about mental speculators. They can't know the Lord, but they try and speculate on the cause of the creation, the ingredients, material causes. We had a discussion somewhat last night in Bhagavad Gita class about, for instance, actually it was that verse in the seventh chapter, Bhumirapo Nalovayu, delineating all the material elements. And then Rishabhdev, who's giving the class, he mentioned how, just like, for instance, Einstein's famous theory that E equals MC squared, that you see even scientists, they acknowledge that when energy slows down, it turns into matter, so there's this progression. So my question is this, as far as I know, in modern physics, they talk about these 11 different dimensions, and then they speculate in different ways, and then as far as I know, the most recent speculation is that in order to fuse all the different theories together to get to this unified field theory is that there's parallel universes. I don't exactly understand how that works, but just my question is any of that have a thread of truth, or is it all speculation? Because, you know, we do have descriptions in the Vedic literature about how there's other realms of sense perception that we have no access to. Is that the same as what they're referring to as parallel?
I'm not familiar with the scientific theories that you're talking about, so I can't answer specifically in regard to those, but we can certainly say that you talk about a thread of truth. You know, that the only thing that anybody can speculate about is Krishna. That's all there is. So whatever anybody speculates about, they're seeing something of Krishna. Now, if they're really in the mode of ignorance, they see things backwards. And if they're in the mode of passion, they get partial truth. And then if they're in the mode of goodness, they actually get truth. But I think we can assume that most of these scientists get parts of the truth. Of course, the problem with partial truth is that a half truth can be a lot more dangerous than a lie. You know, like the five or six blind men looking at the elephant. So if you think that your partial truth is the whole truth, then you may really have a distortion. And because the partial truth has some truth in it, it's not very easy to refute. So therefore, it's more difficult than something that's just a lie. But we know that there are many different universes. We know that there are millions and millions and millions of material universes. We also know that there are different levels of reality that are accessed according to one's level of consciousness. So we know that that's a fact. And people may, through various scientific means, be able to understand more or less of those facts. I remember when I was taking a communication and teaching course. It was very useful and extremely helpful. And what was being taught in the course was all 99.9% in harmony with Krishna consciousness. It was a practical course. But I remember on one of the break times, the participants were sitting around talking about reality. What is reality? You know, who are we? What is God? And I thought, whoa, this is what Prabhupada meant by mental speculation. There was no basis other than just the senses and the mind. I ran into the same thing when I took a required course as part of my PhD in the philosophy of research, where we had to read all these people just giving wild speculations about what is the nature of reality and perception. And I'd say in all cases, people get some element of truth. It's like you say, a thread. There's threads of truth in there, but their conclusions are really strange and not very practical. They hover on a platform where they can't really do anything with what they know. Or maybe they can do something on the gross and subtle platform. And we are advised to stay away from such things. Now, philosophical speculations, where you start with Shabda, where you start with Shastra, with Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, and you try to understand how it's true, that is not only okay, but actually recommended. Prabhupada talked about looking at the Shastra from many angles of vision. We can know, according to Lord Brahma, Pantastu Koti Satavatsara Samphagamyo Vayoratapi Manaso Munipunigavanam Sopyastiyat Prabhadasim Niyabachintitadve, that there's no question. People can go on mentally speculating for millions and millions and millions and millions of years, and they will never come to see the whole truth that way. The reason for this I've explained in another class where I talked about paradigm shifts. And if you really want to understand this, I would suggest that you read Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. I would suggest you read it with a study guide because it's pretty difficult to understand just reading straight. I mean, I couldn't understand it without a study guide. But he explains that basically science, all scientific theories and views are just seeing a part of the truth, and they're able to explain some things and not others. And if they switch their paradigm, then they're able to explain another set of things and not others again, that they're never able to come up with a scientific paradigm that explains everything. They always end up to be anomalous things that they just can't explain. And, of course, you have to take into account that he's talking about science just on this Earth. You know, if the scientists actually had access to other planets and other realms, that would be even more the case. Now, of course, the higher you get in your level of consciousness, the more that you can get a vision of the whole truth. And let's say a little child. So here we have a little baby that can't move on his own. He can't move from one room to the other. So to that little baby, when you go into another part of the house, you're gone. I mean, as soon as you're out of his line of vision, you're gone, and he becomes afraid. And as soon as he progresses and he's able to crawl and he can figure out how the rooms relate to each other, then he won't feel that way anymore. He gets a bigger view of reality. But even the two-year-old or the four-year-old, they don't understand how the streets relate to each other. You know, from their position, we get in the car and somehow we magically end up at the other destination. What to speak of if you get up in an airplane and you see not only how the streets relate to each other, you see how the islands relate to each other and how they relate to other land masses. Or you go up higher in a spaceship and you get beyond the clouding of the atmosphere, and then you can see how the planet relates to other planets. So you get a bigger and bigger and broader understanding of the truth, the more that you're developed in consciousness and in facility. Otherwise, you know, the little baby has some threads of truth, but to the little baby walking in the other room, you're in another universe. You're gone. They don't exist anymore, and they become afraid.
Yeah, you know, I just have to say the analogies that you give are just really, really appreciate. They really bring all of these points of philosophy to life. I mean, how many times have we heard about the elephant? But when you just said that, it just made so much sense. It's really very appropriate.
Therefore, you know, although Prabhupada says in the Ishapanishad, one should become a scientist or a philosopher. So we laud the impetus that the scientists feel. We give them all praise and all encouragement for the impetus that they have to find the truth. Much better to be a scientist and a philosopher than just a common laboring person who just, you know, it's a mode of ignorance, knowledge. You just know your work. Okay, I go to work, I work in the factory, come home, turn on the football game, drink my beer. You know, and what's the meaning of life? I don't know. You know, I'm just trying to get a little bit more money or whatever. So the scientist who's trying to find a unified field theory, when they're looking, at least they're looking for Krishna. They have some concept. I want to find what's the overview. What ties everything together? They're looking for ultimate meaning. You know, everyone's looking for meaning. But some person looks for meaning that, you know, they hold the door open for someone at the bank. And that's their concept of meaning. Or I have a nice picnic out with my kids. And that's their concept of having a meaningful life. You know, I give some charity or whatever. And try to be a good person. So the scientists, they're looking for ultimate meaning. So that's wonderful. The problem is that their tools are insufficient. So it's not, we don't say throw away the tools. We're also using our senses and our mind in Krishna's service. But we're saying if that's the only tools you have, if you only have your senses and mind, you just can't find ultimate meaning like that. You know, you can find little bits and pieces, but you won't see how the little bits and pieces fit together. You won't see, yeah, the blind man and the elk, they don't see how does the tail fit with the ear. What's the relationship between tail and ear? What's the relationship between tail and hole? They never see the hole. So they're not able to figure out how the knowledge they have fits into the hole. And this is why their theories are constantly changing. Now they're not only their theories, but their paradigms are constantly changing. You know, also in science, what do they call it? The decrease effect or diminishing effect. That what they discover, the more experiments they do, the more that whatever they found disappears. They'll find some medical effect of some drug or this or that. And as they do more and more and more studies, instead of more and more and more studies showing how it's true, more and more studies start to show how it's not true. A very nice article was written about this in the New Yorker recently, which I posted on my Facebook page. Why is that? Why is it that, you know, they do some study and it meets all the scientific criteria for being true, and then as they study it with more and more people, the effect diminishes? Of course, what they pointed out in this article was that the scientific journals don't report the diminishing effect. They just report when it's true. And once something is accepted as true, they only report, which is exactly what you would expect according to Kuhn. They don't report the things that don't report it. So I was wondering, well, why does this happen? And those of you who know anything about research, so you always start out with what is called a random sample. In other words, you can't possibly take every human being on the planet and test them to see the effect of this or that drug or this or that procedure or this or that behavior. You can't test all 6 billion people. So what are you going to do? So we have the science of statistics, which theorizes that if you take a certain portion of the population, that you can then extrapolate to the whole population. And they have some parameters. It has to be a random sample of the population. In other words, it's supposedly a sample that if you've chosen it randomly, that if you extrapolated it, would indeed reflect the whole population. You should have basically one of each kind of person. And depending on how big of a total population you're talking about all the humans in the world, all the humans between 20 and 30, all the women or whatever, will determine the size of your random sample. So in your random sample, you find something to be true or something to be false. But then when you replicate the research, guess what? You've got to take a new sample of people. You're not going to replicate the research with the same exact people. And as more and more and more scientists are replicating the research, guess what? They're choosing more and more and more and more people. And as they're choosing more and more and more and more people, they're finding that their so-called random sample that was supposed to be representative, wasn't. And then as soon as they look at everybody, the result goes away. Now that's why for the research that I didn't take a random sample. I actually surveyed the entire population of teachers in the Hare Krishna school. I got 90% of the population to respond to my survey, which was a miracle by God. But anyway, they start, you know, you think something's true, and as you look further and further and further and further and further, you see it's not true. Your results dissipate. And then they have to look for another truth, and so on. In other words, they're not seeing from the whole. They don't know how to see from the whole. They're trying to go part to whole, which is the inductive process. The deductive process is you go whole to part. You first look at the whole, and then from the whole you can understand the part. Or how are you going to first look at the whole is what you're trying to figure out from the first place. Whole, W-H-O-L-E, not H-O-L-E. You know, it seems to be a catch-22. All right, I'm trying to understand the whole, but I only have access to a part. And we're saying, all right, start from the whole. If you start from the whole, you'll understand both the whole and the part. Well, how do I do that? My problem in the first place is I didn't have access to the whole. That was where I started from. Okay, well, then you've got to know the whole from someone who has already accessed the whole. Say, okay, well, that just removes my problem one step. But how do you know somebody's accessed the whole? There's symptoms. If somebody's accessed the whole, then they should, their behavior will be such that will bring them their desired result. That's the ultimate test. Why do the scientists want to have this unified field theory? Why do they want to know how the whole thing works? Of course, they want to know how the whole thing works on an immediate level so they can manipulate it. That's why they're trying to figure out how it works, and that's why the knowledge isn't given to them. You know, why don't we reveal everything about ourselves to people we don't trust? Because they'll use it against us. Gosh, I just wrote a confidential email to somebody that I don't know. I was referred to them by a very dear friend. And instead of getting a reply from the person, I got a reply from the person's secretary. And I thought, oh, no. Here I've revealed my heart to the secretary, not just to the person I wanted to write to. So this is, Krishna is not going to reveal who he is and what is the whole to someone who wants to exploit him. So that's a lot of what their problem is. But why do we want to know the whole? We want to know the whole so that we can achieve our goals. We want to be happy. We want to be peaceful. We want to have knowledge. We want to have eternity. So if somebody has those things, they must be in touch with the whole. So that's our symptom. If you want to know who's in touch with the whole, who has it? Who's peaceful? Who's experiencing ever-expanding happiness? Who's able to understand and explain all the parts in relation to the whole? So there's a, you know, well, the symptoms are given, of course, in the Bhagavad Gita, 2nd chapter, 12th chapter, 14th chapter, and many other places, of the symptoms of a person who actually is in contact with the whole. So then we have to go through that person and we say, okay, tell me what you know. And then to the degree to which we've given up our desire to exploit, to that degree we can also gain that knowledge. And then everything starts coming into place. Once you see the whole picture, all the pieces of the puzzle, you know where they go. And this is what happens as we practice Krishna consciousness, isn't it? As we start chanting, as we practice Krishna consciousness, oh, now I understand that. Oh, now I understand. Now I know how that fits. We gain more and more and more and more realization. So that's the only way to see the whole picture. Starting from the little tools that I have and trying to put the little parts together individually is never going to work. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Hi, all glories to Srila
Prabhupada.
Jai, hi, Krishna.
Hari Bol.